provincial coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Community Watch and Comment will return to you next week. This morning, we hear an episode of The Thinking Muslim, hosted by Muhammad Jalal, who will be in conversation with Francesca Albanese, Special Rapporteur to the United Nations on Palestine. Enjoy.
وقف الطفل وحده والليالي ورصاص من حوله وجنود وقف الطفل والحجارة أكوام وعيناه عزمة وصمود وعيناه عزمة وصمود
image out of my heart when we've seen the bodies found in a mountain of parts. Netanyahu told you just another child of the dark. Clear it's gonna take much more than thousands to march, more than a speech, more than a poem, more than a track of music. Gonna take more than a sit down with Bassem Youssef. Even bringing back ambassadors isn't Atlas useless, long as you pump oil for Apaches and the tanks they use in freedom just beyond reach for people you cannot see. He's wheezing and cannot breathe and screaming through the concrete looking for his four children. The bombs leave structures that I wouldn't want to call buildings. My fingers pointed at this government, you all killed them. Tell me that you wouldn't take up arms if those were your children. Let me make the factor clear, those bombs were manufactured here. And they want the land as theirs because of natural gas in there. Feel death in the atmosphere while we hapless stand and stare. And a little boy begs for his brother's strand of hair. Truth is I don't know how anyone can live after digging for their dead kids buried under bricks. Israel is a terror state, terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televises, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. From the river to the sea, free, 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 free. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. From the river to the sea, free, 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 free.
They bomb churches and paramedics, it's hurting, the panic spreading. Hospitals where the doctors do C-sections, no anesthetics. The pressure is manifesting, humanity stands connected. Masses seem apathetic and actually just accept it. When our grandchildren ask us, what did we do to stop it? I'm determined to say, I did more than make music on it. That's why we shut down arms factories, you can try stopping us. Palestine action's the opposite of white phosphorus. We tell them on the television, but they never listen. Tell Piers Morgan that resistance isn't terrorism. They want them fled or missing, death or prison, endless killing. I seen a father hold his baby up, the head was missing. Imagine demolition of home where your parents live in. Kings won't say a thing, but at least we know that Yemen's with them. Ethnic cleansing, it ain't hard to see the stages, but Gaza is a graveyard of the invaders. Ears close to the savagery, clear though when there's clarity. The journalists and doctors are heroes of humanity. As sordid and as gory as this story is for now, and they depopulating Gaza for Ben-Gurion's canal. Israel is a terrorist state. Terrorists that terrorize. I testify my television, televise, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die.
Palestine is a test for humanity. Gaza has been destroyed. They have entrapped, encircled, starved, killed, maimed, tortured.
Are you more or less hopeful about international justice?
There are double standards and now they're fully exposed.
David Lammy, our foreign secretary, was asked in parliament a question about whether he would describe Gaza to be a genocide.
David Lammy is not the only genocide denier. What constitutes genocide is established. Arab states should be the first in complying with international law when it comes to Palestine. There are countries who maintain economic ties, diplomatic ties, but especially military and financial ties with Israel. What happens to me happens to many.
The slaughter in Gaza progresses in a haze of silence. The West has colluded with Israel to provide military assistance, political legitimacy, diplomatic cover, and financial resources. Gaza is a perfect murder scene. A graveyard not only of tens of thousands of children, but a graveyard of a defunct order that has been exposed as nothing but an empty set of rules to beat opponents and protect friends from prosecution. Should we, people who remain married to justice, accept that international law, if it ever did work, is today defunct? In a broader sense, when we pursue its application, are we in danger of creating a sense of false hope? These are the existential questions we are now asking ourselves as the genocide proceeds at pace into its second years. My guest today is Francesca Albanese, an international lawyer who has been in the eye of the storm, speaking truth at the highest levels. Francesca specializes in international humanitarian law and is the special rapporteur for the UN reporting on Palestine. Francesca, welcome to The Thinking Muslim.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's lovely to have you with us. Now, Francesca, 13 months of slaughter. Isn't it time to accept that international law is obsolete?
Before I answer that, I was listening to you and there are a few words that caught my attention and I wouldn't agree with the framing.
Please.
We are not into 13 months of silence around genocide. It's silencing. Because the world is in turmoil. All Western countries have seen protests for 30 months and arrest and detention and repression toward protesters. Not because of violence. I'm not saying that there were no violent acts occasionally committed, but the protests have largely been peaceful and there has been silence. And there has been silencing and through smear and attacks of voices who have tried to stand against this, to call attention, to point at the way forward. And here we go to the allegedly defunct international law system. I do not think that international law is the problem per se.
Yeah.
We have a set of norms and mechanisms to prevent, to stop and punish crimes all the more a crime as insidious, as vicious as genocide. But it's not working. And to be honest, it has not worked in previous instances, like in the case of Rwanda or Bosnia. But there have been other cases, like in Central America. We tend not to see, we are so Western-centered that we don't see that, in fact, genocide, in as much as is abhorrent, is not an exception. Why so? Because the system doesn't respond. So the problem is to be found, and the system is to be interrogated in what is deficient, is what is not functioning in it. There is an inner discrimination and bias, and Western countries are somewhat responsible for it. There are double standards, and now they're fully exposed.
I think it was May that the ICC chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, issued an application for arrest to the court. Yet months later, we haven't yet had a decision from the court. And I think I remember over Russia and Ukraine, the decisions that came from the ICC were fairly rapid. Mm. What accounts then for the lack of attention to what is a genocide?
I think you're right in a sense for Russia, the indictment came, I think, within 11 months. Mm. From the announcement of the opening of the investigation.
Yes.
Palestine, it has going on forever, and the investigation is now three year old. But only after October 7, the prosecutor really accelerated its office capacity to investigate and collect evidence. So this is already a sign that something was not working.
Yeah.
But yet, after May, the International Court has come under increasing pressure, attacks, smear, threats from governments like the US and other powerful organizations. It's not easy. It's not easy to work in this toxic environment. And clearly, justice is hijacked on the way. You know, retributive justice can be delivered through various means and channels. And while the International Criminal Court is the international mechanism supposed to deliver that kind of justice, to deliver accountability, this is not the only one. There are domestic courts which have universal jurisdiction. So actions against alleged perpetrators of genocide could be initiated in this country as well. Why doesn't it happen?
Yeah, arguably the ICJ has moved at a slightly more faster pace. There was that interim judgment which suggested that there may be a plausible genocide as well as judgments on the occupied territories in the West Bank. Yet without the backing of the international community, it's fairly clear that those judgments are not really going to have much of an effect. I mean, is that a fair reading of where the ICJ is?
Well, the ICJ has issued three sets of provisional measures. Mm. And had those measures been complied with, we would have seen the end of what the court has recognized being a plausible genocide.
Yes.
Or being plausibly a genocide. And it has not been acted upon. The court is currently investigating whether there is a state responsibility for genocide, and it might take years. This is not just because it's difficult to establish genocidal intent at the state level. It's also because the court has different cases to deal with.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the Genocide Convention sets three obligations: to prevent, stop, and punish genocide. And the trigger is when there is an indication that genocide might be committed, when there is genocidal incitement. Incitement to genocide is a crime in and of itself. So this is the signal. And the court in January this year found that where Israeli leaders, it named them, Israeli leaders who had incited to commit acts of genocide, they should have been investigated. And this could have already had a deterrent effect. Unfortunately, nothing has moved. At the political level, arms have continued to flow into Israel. And member states have even found creative ways to circumnavigate the legal obstacles, the potential judicial scrutiny at national level, investing in indirect transfer. So you see, what we are facing now is the system in its pure form. It's not that especially Western states, political elites, with a few exceptions, are standing with Israel as it commits genocide because there is a cohesion or a convergence of interest. This is the system we are facing.
Yes.
So it's not that the system is not working. The system is working to protect certain interests, and in the way, not only they are slaughtering the Palestinians, not only they are paving the way toward the burial of the international order, but they are also crushing fundamental freedoms within their own states in order to silence the solidarity with the Palestinians, the solidarity to stop a genocide. This is paradoxical.
Yeah.
Because we have had genocides before, but never there has been this apology of the crime at the international level. Politicians and media alike have been working together for that. Never we have had such a resistance, such an opposition, such a revolution brewing really around the globe to stop it. And seeing its silence is also a sign that the system is turning less and less liberal toward its own constituencies in the West.
I suppose what I'm trying to work out is whether you are more or less hopeful about international justice working. And I think you've written, forgive me if I'm mistaken here, but you've now published 5 reports at the United Nations, 2 of which document genocide. I mean, since your first report, from the first report to now, are you more or less hopeful about international justice?
Not sure hopeful is the right term. Hmm. I'd say motivated and anxious to see it work, because I do think that we do not have many peaceful tools to take us out of here. And I want to see it work because, again, human rights are somewhat the codification of civil struggles against slavery, against apartheid, for recognition of farmer rights, food sovereignty, indigenous rights, gender equality. I mean, it's a continuous struggle, yes, but we build on each struggle and we become stronger. This is the challenge now. We need to be able to see that in what is at risk in Palestine. Palestine is a test for humanity versus like permanent war, a state of war between the system and the people.
Mm.
Therefore, if we all take part to this and become like a bigger movement, building on the intersectionality of the struggles, also understanding how fragile we are in our societies. We struggle standing in solidarity with one another because the system is such that we risk our job, we risk our reputation, and it's very difficult to break these barriers. But I wonder if this is not the moment to do that because we have been fragilized enough. So, yeah, this is where I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that people will realize what we are standing against and we use the tools we have to make it happen.
there seems to be a reluctance, certainly in the West, to use the word genocide, whether that's in the media and certainly in political circles. You may have seen a few weeks back, David Lammy, our foreign secretary, was asked in Parliament a question about whether he would describe Gaza to be a genocide. And he said the scale of the killings was nowhere near a genocide. So he dismissed it outright. How is genocide defined, and how would you respond to Lammy's?
Excuse me, I can't believe that. He's a lawyer, isn't he?
Yes, a human rights lawyer.
All right. I'm surprised because the first instinct of a lawyer would be to look at the legal documents, the jurisprudence, and probably David Lammy has to explain to the public where did he read that is the number of people killed who define genocide. Probably David Lammy should read Article 2.4 of the Genocide Convention, which refers to an act of genocide that doesn't even involve the killing of one person.
Really?
Or the fifth. I mean, there is genocide through forceful transfer of children. And this is how the genocide in Australia has been mainly perpetrated, and including in Canada. So this is why I insist on the settler colonial framework.
Yeah.
While David Lammy is not the only genocide denier, I think that it's particularly serious when it comes from someone who has a position of authority, who carries an even greater authority because he's a man of law. But excuse me, what constitutes genocide is established by Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, not personal opinions. And it's the intent, the determination to destroy a group in all or in part through several, even one only of these acts, killing, infliction of severe bodily or mental harm, and creations of conditions of life which would bring about the destruction of the group. And look at Gaza today. Gaza has been destroyed. Most of the civilian infrastructure, arable land, all universities, the civil registry, the national archive, the historical and religious cultural heritage of that place, the medical infrastructure, all universities, all schools. How does David Lammy call this? Is it a war? I'm very concerned because this is not a war. If this is a war, we are entering a new stage where war doesn't respect anything that has to do with civilian life. And this is to be pushed back. So whatever ignorance exists there, it can be resolved with a good reading of what genocide is and how it has been commented on and developed as a concept through international jurisprudence.
Can I ask you about the reluctance in the West generally to call out Israel? And you've spoken to this in previous answers, but of course, maybe one can accept that the Americans are very wedded to a pro-Israel policy and maybe some elements of European policy is very much linked to Israel. But you have institutions like the EU, Ursula von der Leyen comes to mind, the president of the European Council, who has been a staunch, unflinching supporter of Israel, regardless of what it does. Like, what accounts? The European Union is known in the textbooks as the symbolic liberal institution that cherishes the concept of human rights. So what's gone wrong in these international bodies?
I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that question, but because I do look at things from a legal perspective.
Right.
And I don't know why they are doing that, but in the process, they are crushing fundamental freedoms, as I was saying.
Right.
What officials like Ursula von der Leyen are showing is that the system is at the service of political interests more than legal claims. Than more than fundamental rights. It applies to the Palestinians, who, by the way, even before the last 13 months, were oppressed. They couldn't enjoy the right of self-determination. Where were these people who were so staunchly in line with Israel, even at the time it's committing genocide. Exactly there, they have been enabling Israel's impunity. They've been enabling for decades the dispossession, the devastation of Palestinians' collective life, inch by inch, the take of home by home, piece of land after piece of land. So it's a continuum. It shouldn't shock us. But the thing that is new is how fiercely the system is turning against European citizens in Germany, in France, in Italy, pretty much everywhere, so that no one can utter criticism or can actively mobilize against the genocide and the oppression of the Palestinian people.
Yeah, I listened to a really good interview, I think with Chris Hedges, where you suggested that Israel has the capacity, or you suggested that genocide was dormant within Israel and it's somewhat been awakened by recent events. Like, are you suggesting that, in a sense, October the 7th was an excuse to conduct or to hurry or to accelerate this policy of the ethnic cleansing?
I wouldn't use the term excuse, but certainly it provided an opportunity. Mm. When we look at settler colonial genocidal history, this is what happens. This is why the settler colonial framing is so important.
Yeah, explain that to me.
Yeah. And I understand that for some, for Jewish people who do not see what we are seeing, this is an extremely loaded and painful term. But let's just look at what is happening in the occupied Palestinian territory, meaning the land, the little that remains of the land that was Palestine until 1948.
Yeah.
And of course, there is a history before this. But however, just if we look at that land, which is occupied and has occupied since 1967, there were limits to what Israel could and could do in that land. Israel, as of 1967, has been an occupying power, hence an administrator of the land. Instead, Israel started to manipulate the local legal system, to demote the local institutions, to take the land, to push out the Palestinians from that land, and to build settlements, colonies for Jewish Israeli only, or people coming from all over the world. As long as you are Jew, Jewish person, you can enter, you can live in Israel, and including in the colonies. Mm-hmm. Colonies after colonies, now 100,000 Israelis live in the occupied Palestinian territory. This is a crime per se. And over time, the repression of the Palestinian has become impossible. Almost 1 million people had been, 1 million Palestinians, including children as young as 12, had been arrested and detained over 57 years of occupation, during which Israel has established, why it's called apartheid, has established a dual legal system. So there was civil law for the Israelis, and martial law for the Palestinians. Military orders written by soldiers, enforced by soldiers, reviewed in military court by soldiers. For 57 years, Palestinians, even children, have been facing military courts, martial law. This is an aberration. And if you look at the legal regime that applies, I mean, the Palestinians are a security threat within this system. So the situation was already bad before October 7. And why so? Because Israel has steadily tried to take as much land as possible by pushing Palestinians into these confinement zones, like reserves or Bantustan, people call it different way, the Area A zones. Look, there are different views on what happened on October 7, but the thing is, the violence of that day, which was brutal for the Israelis, but that brutality was also there were fabrications attached to it, like the beheading of 40 babies, the mass rape, and other horror stories that have been circulated, which frankly I found somewhat disrespectful and belittling toward the Israeli victims themselves. I mean, is it less grievous what they endured without these barbarian fabrications? No, but it tells the story, and this is why we go to settler colonialism, of the narrative of the superior civilization which is facing the barbarians. So this is why October 7, building on the rage, on the frustration, and on decades of dehumanization of the Palestinians, because one needs to read how Palestinians are discussed in Israeli textbooks, and it's very dehumanizing. So this was the toxic mix that made a social consensus behind what the Israeli politicians were doing. So I don't think Israel had the excuse. Israel had the opportunity to escalate the violence. And I've seen it from the very beginning. It was leading toward ethnic cleansing. But meanwhile, they have committed acts of genocide. They have entrapped, encircled, starved, killed, maimed, tortured, raped, not only the Palestinians in Gaza, but the same acts of violence have metastasized, expanded beyond the borders of Gaza and are entrapping people in the West Bank. So this is why I say we need to see that there is a destructive intent, and it's set. I mean, it's expressed, verbalized by the Israeli leaders toward the totality of the Palestinians in the totality of the land. And this is why we need to capture the genocidal intent in the totality of conducts and crimes that are committed. The settler colonial genocide is this: taking of the land, taking of the resources, pushing out the people. So there is a dormant gene which is genocidal in settler colonialism, and it explodes when there is resistance from the indigenous people.
You argued recently at the United Nations that Israel should be isolated internationally for what it's done and what it's continuing to do in Gaza. In the absence of support from the West, I mean, how can this be realized?
First of all, let me explain why I recommended the United Nations to suspend Israel's credentials as a member of the United Nations. Now, I'm aware that Israel is not the only country who has an appalling human rights record, although we have to concede to the fact that this year, after 57 years of unlawful occupation of a people who's not made of Israel's citizens, these are people who can't even vote, who do not have rights. But this year, Israel has sort of lost all restraints, and the violations of international law have become of the extreme. However, there is something that is really unprecedented. It signals a tragedy within the tragedy. This year, Israel has targeted the United Nations like no other state ever, no other state before. In fact, it has bombed and or attacked, damaged or destroyed 70% of the UN infrastructure in the Gaza Strip. It has killed 237 UN staff members. It has attacked Palestinians as they were sheltered by the UN, either in its premises or as they were gathering for healthcare and food distribution. It has destroyed the UN distribution lines. It has attacked UN convoys, hampered the UN humanitarian function, from vaccination to provision of, again, and basic forms of protection to the Palestinians in Gaza. On top of it, it has also launched a smear campaign against the UN General Assembly, the International Criminal Court, the Human Rights Council, the Secretary General has been PNG'd, myself, and of course it has taken action against, causing much reputational damage to a number of UN independent experts like myself. I'm not the only one, I'm the most visible one, but there are 30 independent experts who have spoken out against Israel's genocide, and they are being targeted. On top of it, Israel has recently, in its attack against Lebanon, it has also hit and it continues to hit the peacekeepers. And on top of it, it has also passed a law which bans, prevents a UN organization to work in the occupied Palestinian territory, UNRWA. This is an act of the parliament, because other UN organizations had been kicked out more easily, like the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights 3 years ago. So you see, this is not a normal state. This is not normal violations by a state. This is an assault on the UN, which needs to be dealt with accordingly.
Can I turn to the Arab countries? Also at that meeting at the United Nations, you said that many of the Arab and Muslim countries are not showing sufficient solidarity towards the Palestinians. What do you mean by that? What do you expect these countries, which I agree with, by the way, they haven't shown very much solidarity at all, but what should we expect from them?
When I talk about solidarity, I use the term that resonates very strongly across the Arab world.
Yeah.
Because there has always been, since the beginning of, or since even before the Nakba, there has been solidarity with the Palestinian brothers and sisters. But as I wrote in my book a few years ago about Palestinian refugees in international law, and I've looked at how Arab countries, among others, have interacted with the question of Palestine through the prism of Palestinian refugees, of the Palestinians displaced around the world and those who are still in the region or who have been kicked out of the region. Hmm. I call it an unsettling solidarity. This is the relationship that Arab countries have traditionally, Arab states, yes, Arab authorities, because I think that this is the difference between the people and the rulers is of the extreme. And Arab rulers have often been ambiguous or not very supportive of the Palestinian struggle, of the question of Palestine. And how do I think this needing correction? Arab states should be the first in complying with international law when it comes to Palestine. So there are Arab countries who are members of, who are parties to the Rome Statute. Why they do not lodge a file, they don't make submissions to the ICC on Palestine? The arguments that are made are insignificant, substantially. They show that there is no interest in pursuing accountability. Mm. Worse than that, there are countries who still maintain, apart from the normalizers,
yes,
this is something that could have used to advance human rights for the Palestinians and does not, but there are countries who maintain economic ties, diplomatic ties, but especially military and financial ties with Israel, which are incredibly detrimental to the Palestinians and also to their own societies. The two things go hand in hand, because it's not just about what Israel produces in terms of military service, surveillance services that are experimented on the body, individual and collective body of the Palestinian, but it's also what Israel sells to these countries that then become tools to repress local constituencies. This is the cycle that we need to break. And I hope to see, because there are Arab, I mean, it's not that the Arab region is a monolith. No. There are countries who have steadily been against the system. They have been outspoken. Now, a number of those who were more outspoken have been silenced. I mean, also because they have their own trouble, Iraq, Syria, and Libya. Libya is one of the countries who have joined the South Africa in the ICJ proceeding, but many more needs to do that. But it's, again, I think that it's important to be honest once and for all and decide which stance to take. It's either or, it's either with or against. This, we are at this breaking point.
When I came across, I met Naledi Pandor, Dr. Pandor, on the weekend, and she's a brave campaigner, of course, who was instrumental in lodging that complaint to the ICJ. But how much, how, in your mind, how successful do you think that ICJ complaint will be, since major countries, in particular Arab countries, haven't really signed up to that?
No, I think it's problematic. Yeah. Because what made the success of the ICJ advisory opinion, which determined, which concluded that the occupation Israel maintains in Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem is unlawful and to be undone totally and unconditionally as rapidly as possible, and the General Assembly has said by September 2025, what was... I think that the fact that this ICJ advisory opinion turned so radically revolutionary in terms of it's broad, it's a watershed decision that covers the history, that tackles all the critical issues, that delivers much more than was expected, including in pointing out the responsibilities of all member states, including private organizations and international organizations. What made it possible was the fact that there was a huge participation of the international community. There were 60 submissions made. And this is probably the most watched and among the streamlined cases of the ICJ. I mean, there were so many people connected watching it. The thing is that the court judges tend to be conservative in the application of international law. It's not there is, again, this is an observation that I make based on where the jurisprudence is, which is okay. But the fact of having state practice brought to the fore, to the court, and showing that this is unacceptable and justice should be pursued as fast as possible, it's something that would create a momentum for the court to pronounce itself. So this is why it's still important. The other thing is that this case, while it will take time, it's creating an awareness that a genocide is ongoing. Had South Africa not done so, we wouldn't be talking so with such a sense of confidence. Also because the evidence that the South Africa legal team has produced is incredible. So it alleviates the burden on all of us, including, I mean, my office doesn't have many means and doesn't have the possibility to go out there and investigate, and also the outreach to collect evidence I have is limited. But then there is the Commission of Inquiry, the South Africa legal team, or the Nicaragua legal team, which initiated a case against Germany. So this is bringing awareness, and one day there will be justice for the Palestinians.
I mean, recently there's been, not recently, it's probably been ongoing, but it's probably accelerated. There's been a coordinated attack on you, accusing you of anti-Semitism. And I think it was all around that UN meetings that you had. Can I ask you about the personal impact of that? I mean, you still persevere and you're still going, and it's fantastic. But also how... maybe anti-Semitism has sometimes been weaponized, if that's not a hard term, to silence criticism of Israel.
I don't want to talk about me because, again, I am one among many. And while I have privileges and immunities, there are hundreds and hundreds of individuals who do not have that, who do not have the visibility I have. So they are punished, smeared, silenced, fired, reprimanded, the object of reputational damage that it's hard to fix in the dark, in the shadow. I want to shed light on those, because what happens to me happens to many. including Jewish people, Palestinians, of course, but including Jewish people. There have been Jewish scholars who have been fired because of their stance, because of their factual and legal analysis or historical analysis of what's happening in Palestine, because they are speaking of genocide or of the illegal occupation and apartheid before. So this is a long trend that is becoming more and more severe now. But what does it show? The weakness of the other side, because they have nothing to challenge us on the facts and on the principles. And so they try to attack us on nonsense. It's nonsense. And the only way to, I tend to ignore the attacks because they're so distracting. They're annoying. Yes, but why would I bother with this when there is a genocide ongoing? I want to talk about that. And I want to see how we collectively act to stop that and let the genocidal minions rally.
And this using anti-Semitism as a tool to silence opposition to the genocide.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that as a tool? Yeah.
It's serious. It's vicious. So let's unpack it. Anti-Semitism exists. There is no question about that. It's revolting. It's disgusting that after, especially in Europe, after all we've have had and done to the Jewish people, having still traces of anti-Semitism lingering is something that blows my mind. But let's see, what is anti-Semitism? Anti-Semitism is discrimination against the Jews because they're Jews. Like anti-Palestinian racism is discrimination against the Palestinians because they are Palestinians. And this is something we need to talk about because it's not in the spotlight as it should. And in fact, the pro-Israel groups and lobby and the cohorts, acolytes, what they're doing, they're using anti-Semitism and the fear it induces in anyone. I've seen it on myself. The first time I was accused of anti-Semitism, I was paralyzed for days. I said, I was confused. I said, am I? What have I done? And then the beauty of it is that there were Jewish scholars and Jewish people, organizations and friends who have, they have helped me overcome this fear of speaking out, saying this is the way they silence everyone, including us. We cannot confuse anti-Semitism with a critique of what Israel does. And in fact, I tell you, very clearly, that Israel could be led by Muslims, atheists, Buddhists, anyone. You wouldn't change my critique. So this allegation that whomever criticizes Israel is an anti-Semite is period. And let me tell you even more, it's stupid. And the fact that people get intimidated shows how weak is the system. I mean, we are rational creatures and we don't have the brain functioning enough to react to this. It blows my mind.
Can I ask you about just the transformational effect of Gaza on lots of young people? Of course, we've seen encampments across Europe and in America. And a lot of my viewers are young Muslims who are starting out in life. A lot of them are studying law at universities. And many of them have really been moved by Gaza and have been activated by Gaza. I mean, what advice would you give them moving forward? How do they stay active and avoid the pitfalls of a corporate world that wants to buy their silence, really?
Yeah, I think this is the moment to choose who you want to be. And I relate with what you're saying. I see that because, I mean, those of us who are older see that something that the young generations might not realize. There's never, while Palestinians have suffered oppression, injustice, wars after wars, destruction. Think of Jenin during the Second Intifada. How many times the people in Jenin have seen destruction, right, really wrote upon them without being given acknowledged. So now it's on full display and it's triggering solidarity. This is excellent. This shows us that we are human, that we are all connected. And that interconnectedness now has a potential to make us better understand what solidarity means, standing together means. And it has two sort of consequences. This determines who we decide to be in the what you call the corporate world we decided to step in. I'm not saying don't step into the corporate world, but when you do, don't forget your principles. Don't be silenced. They cannot silence all of us. And this is the second element. Don't forget what alliances mean made of solidarity. The world we live in has sort of created barriers around all of us as individuals, confining us in a corner of fragility. And solidarity allows to break those walls and stand united and federate. And it goes to the first point. They cannot fire us all. They cannot silence us all. If we find the strength to stand against a genocide, we need to keep that fire and continue to fight against injustice. I know that many people feel hopeless, but we do not have that luxury. Because like the people in Gaza, they cannot choose. They can only strive for survival. Who are we to call ourselves hopeless? We need to do everything we can to stop this genocide and learn what this standing together has taught us.
One final question for you. There is a question that I ask a lot of my guests, and that's one of just resilience and motivation. We've seen 13 months now of this genocide. And I don't know, people maybe are becoming slightly more desensitized to the pictures. Maybe that's a bit too harsh, but there is a sense that we've tried everything. We've protested in England, here in London, we protested in great numbers, in hundreds of thousands, but it doesn't seem to make an impact. David Lammy is still saying there is no genocide taking place in Gaza. How do you stay motivated in such an unjust world, Francesca?
And this is where I think that the colonial and imperial historical amnesia play in. Because we tend to live so much in the moment that we seem to have forgotten the struggles that led us to the freedom we enjoy today. Again, we need to think of the people who have fought against slavery. It was not that long ago that, even if we want to keep the genocidal experiences aside, but until a few years ago, even in the West, in the United States, there were people who were segregated, like in South Africa. And we've never called what the African Americans endured as apartheid, but I don't think that an analysis of it would fail to understand how apartheid did exist and was practiced upon them. And in fact, we could go further and see what has happened to the indigenous people, the Native Americans in the United States, who are totally invisibilized. The original and the continuous owner of the land are these people. So we need to understand that we are a small part of history, but our actions will determine both the present and the future. This is what builds a revolution, is the necessity, the impossibility to live with the status quo. If we do not push back on this, it means that the status quo is still convenient to us, which is a reflection of our selfishness. And again, we need to be put in front of a mirror, and today we need to decide who we want to be and the kind of future we want to secure for ourselves, our families, for the planet. And again, this is the moment to make a choice. This can be a revolution.
Francesca Albanese, thank you very much for giving us hope. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
We won't forget.
We won't.
We won't forget. We won't forget.
We won't forget.
We won't forget.
We won't.
Dean Squad. Shout out.
Check it out.
forget the mandem. We won't forget the children, can't resurrect them. Can't forget that we got censored. And for those who didn't speak out, trust me, we remember. We won't forget the violence or the tyrants who wanna dehumanize us. These times are unprecedented. First we wanted peace, now we want vengeance. A million refugees looking for shelter. I can't believe they put their hands out, we didn't help them. Can't drink the poison. Don't forget Starbucks funded the oppression. The list goes on, the boycott's coming. The boycott feelings and his anger is summoned. Can you feel the tension burning in your stomach? Allah by my side won't surrender to nothing. And we won't forget nothing.
From Palestine to the Congo, we won't forget. Worldwide feed them pronto. We won't respect. From Palestine to the Congo, bring the fire to the jungle. Hear the sound of the bongos. If you hear me, say it once more. We won't forget.
From Palestine to Congo, I'm so tired of being humble. Meet me in the jungle. On a block like my tumbo. Hear the sound of the bongo. Then the town of rumble. They write their names on the umbo. So they just in case a bomb blow. They might turn the jundo. Start a pot like it's gumbo. If y'all can't get a piece of the pot, I'll let it crumble.
On n'oublie pas les bombes qu'ils ont lancées sur nous pour cela. Nous vengerons par les chansons et nos voix. Prends cet enfant dans tes bras. Desde el río al mar, Palestine sera libre. No pueden tratarnos como juguetes. No olvidaremos a los inocentes que mataron a ustedes. Mi Sudán y la Gaza. نتذكر ولا ننسى. بروح بالدم النصر قريب حد وعدنا. فلسطين دوالرم داسن أول دورلين شوجكلار النقمية جاز. Onlar için savaşıyoruz biz. Sonsuza kadar. From Palestine to the Congo. We won't forget. Worldwide freedom pronto.
We won't forget, nah, nah. We won't forget.
We won't forget. We won't forget. We won't forget.
We won't forget.
Still, it's a real good bet. The best is yet to come.
Hi, this is Robin Holden, the proprietor of Robin's Place, every Friday evening from 7 until 10 p.m. Robin's Place is a mythical entertainment center consisting of four floors. On each floor of Robin's Place, we have rooms that are named after people who I think are icons in music, theater, and literature. We have the Nancy Wilson Room, the Joe Williams Room, the Gloria Lynn Room, the Frank Sinatra Room, the B.B. King Blues Room, the James Baldwin Library, just to name a few. Join me Friday nights from 7 until 10 p.m. as I take you on a musical journey you'll never forget. Robin's Place.
Come the day you're mine, I'm gonna teach you to fly.
What do Angela Davis, Mehdi Hasan, Ibrahim X. Kendi, V, formerly Eve Ensler, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, Sonia Sanchez, Amy Goodman, Medea Benjamin, Mosab Abu Toha, Congresswoman Cori Bush, Noura Erekat, Congressman Jamal Bowman, Farafina Khan, Linda Sarsour, Isra Shakir, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and WPFW have in common? Well, Busboys and Poets 2025 Peace Ball, Voices of Justice and Liberation, an event featuring live music, speeches, performances, food, and drink. Details, including a complete list of speakers and performers, as well as how you can both support WPFW and join the fun on Saturday, January 18th, 8 p.m. at Arena Stage's Mead Center for American Theater, can be found at WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
We're back.
WPFW is excited to announce the return of the Social Justice Calendar, your go-to weekly update on the latest events, actions, and initiatives promoting equity, justice, and change across our community. The calendar's mission is to connect you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Each week, we'll spotlight rallies, workshops, forums, and community actions happening across the region. If you have an event to share, submit